Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Melissa Bilardi, your host on Help for HD. Tonight, we are recording live and podcasting all about help for juvenile Huntington's disease. The goal every week is to introduce incredible special guests to educate and inspire you. Thanks to all of you. We now have 5,900 listeners and counting. Our call-in numbers tonight are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. When you call in, press 1 and I'll cue you into the show. Please tell all your friends and family about the show and click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. We have a very special JHD program tonight and an incredible special guest. I'm thrilled to introduce Martha A. Nance, MD. She has been director of the HD Center of Excellence at Hennepin County Medical Center since 1991. She received her Bachelor's of Science degree from Yale, her MD from Medical College of Virginia, and completed her training in neurology and in genetics from the University of Minnesota. She's now an adjunct professor in the Department of Neurology at the University of Minnesota. She also serves as the medical director of the Struthers Parkinson Center at Park Nicollet Clinic, where she maintains an active clinical and research practice. And I hear she loves to spend time in her vegetable garden and flower garden. Welcome to Help for HD, Dr. Nance. How are you tonight?
Well, I'm doing fine. It's really a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you. I'm so happy to have you. And I was able to get you out of your garden.
Barely. I've been weeding all weekend and picked some strawberries. So.
Oh, very nice. So what all are you growing now?
Oh, you know, a little of this and a little of that, but you know, it's some beans and peas and corn and my favorite my flowers that I like to grow are the dahlias. So they don't bloom till later in the summer. So
I'm so envious. I used to garden quite a bit and. I don't have the property now to do that, but, oh, man, do I miss it. So let's talk about JHD. Tell us about your background and what brought you to the field of neurology and genetics.
You know, that's always one of those long stories or short story, depending on which version you give. I always found the brain to be an interesting part of the body, and when I went to medical school, I was pleased to find that I wasn't frustrated by taking on problems that I couldn't solve. So when I went to medical school, they were just barely introducing CAT scans. I know this makes me sound Neanderthal, but CAT scans were just coming out. MRI scans were just being invented. And genetics is another area that I've always been interested in. And it really was one of these sort of twists of fate that the day I finished my genetics fellowship, the woman who had run our Huntington's disease clinic in Minneapolis left for a different job. And so there I am, a newly minted neurologist geneticist with a Huntington's clinic just waiting to be directed. And so I kind of have been running that center ever since I finished my training.
So that's great. How did your education prepare you for the work that you're doing now with JHD?
Well, you know, obviously juvenile HD is combines all the features of adult HD with some added twists. And as an adult neurologist, I think many of us feel a little bit uncomfortable around children, even if it's a child with a disease we think of as an adult disease, because we're just uncomfortable around children, having trained in adult neurology. My genetics training actually helps with that, because much of what I did during my genetics training was working with babies and children and parents and so on. So I actually think that having a little bit of formal training in genetics makes it a little bit easier for me to dive into the juvenile Huntington's families.
Is it just that it's scary, or it's more devastating, or?
Well, it's sort of different. If you're accustomed to adult, there are many things that are different about pediatric medicine than adult medicine. you know, the patients are smaller.
And
oftentimes you are immediately interacting with two people, not just one. In adult medicine, it may just be, you know, the person who's got the problem that comes in to talk to you, and you just sit down and talk about it, and nobody else ever has to hear about it, and you don't really have to, as a physician, you don't have to tailor your presentation so that two or three different people understand it. You're just talking to the person who's got the problem.
Maybe but there's a higher emotional...
Yeah, immediately when you're and parents of sick children are not happy people, as you well know.
I
think it's harder to be a parent of a sick child.
Right.
I think is more difficult than having an illness yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I think any of us would do anything we could to remove illness from our children, whereas if it's something that you're putting up with, you know how much it hurts or how much it doesn't hurt or how much you can go on with it. But it's hard to be a parent, and I think then it's harder for physicians because they have to deal with the parent and with the child both.
Well, I know as a parent, you know, you feel so helpless when you're trying to, you know, alleviate pain or, you know, any pain and suffering in your child, you just feel so helpless sometimes. But
right.
So how many, you are the director of your HDSA, is it HD clinic or HDSA clinic?
Well, it is the Huntington's Disease Clinic at Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis, which is one of the 21 HDSA designated centers of excellence.
And how many families do you see there?
Yeah, I always have a hard time answering that question because people come and go, and
right.
We probably are aware of several hundred families in Minnesota with HD, not all of which are active at any one time. And we actually have a nursing home that has a special unit just for people with Huntington's disease. So they have a 30 or 40 bed unit just for people with Huntington's.
Looks like we might have a caller. Let me check and see if they have a question for you. Hold on.
All right.
Hi, this is Melissa. You're on Help for HD. Can I help you? Hello. I muted them. They may just want to be listening. Anyway, so and then from the center, do you see many HD kids? How many do you see there?
Well, you know, kids with juvenile Huntington's kind of, again, come and go over the years, and we only ever have a handful at any one time. So we probably have no more than two or three children who are actually under the age of 18 that we're following at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
The nursing home tends to acquire a fair number of people who probably had juvenile onset HD, and actually I have several of these too, people whose onset was in their teenage years, but they are now 25 or 30 years old. So they're not really kids anymore, but they're adults with juvenile HD.
Okay, now, why is the diagnosis for JHD so difficult?
You're going to ask the hardest question first.
Why not?
Yeah, I think doctors are, so one issue is that, there are several issues. One issue is that truly sometimes the first symptom of Huntington's disease in a child is severe, awful behavioral problems.
Mm-hmm.
But doctors, me included, are quite reluctant to make a diagnosis of Huntington's disease in a kid who has no motor symptoms, no obvious cognitive symptoms, but is just acting up at age 13.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause every kid in the world acts up at age 13. And kind of by definition, kids with juvenile HD come from a family where there's HD, and there's often an affected father in the house, and so it's a family under stress. And so is the 13-year-old kid acting out because they have Huntington's disease, or are they acting out in the situation of a stressful, difficult, challenging family situation? And doctors really don't want to be wrong. We especially, you don't want to tell somebody they have Huntington's disease and then 5 years later say, oops, you know, I think we were wrong. I don't think it really was HD. It was just, you know, being a teenager.
Right. Well, you have blood tests for that, right?
For teenagers?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so that's one issue. The second issue is, is what doctor do you go to? So primary care doctors, you know, whether adult or pediatrics doctors, are not very knowledgeable about Huntington's disease. General neurologist or the general pediatric neurologist is also not going to be very familiar with HD.
Mm-hmm.
And even the adult HD experts may feel, again, a little bit uncomfortable around children. So we're used to seeing adults with the disease, but we all see only a handful of kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the symptoms are subtle or mild or unclear or uncertain, the doctor may be a little bit reluctant to leap immediately to diagnosis of HD. The blood test is a whole other problem. So I actually discourage people from getting a blood test on a kid the very first time they come in the door. What if you do the gene test and it turns out that the child has 38 repeats or 41 repeats? The CAG repeat length tends to be much larger in children than it does in adults.
Mm-hmm.
So we associate larger gene mutations with earlier onset ages.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you do a gene test on the kid and the abnormal gene has a very low abnormal number of repeats, like 38 or 40 or 41,
mm-hmm.
you don't really know that that has anything to do with the symptoms that the child is currently having.
Right. It could just be a matter of observing the child for a while to see
right.
if there's a progression
and
or whatever.
That's right. So
right.
one of the hallmarks of Huntington's disease is that it is a progressive neurodegenerative disease. So if the child truly has HD in 6 months or a year, the difference between that child and other normal children of the same age will get bigger. You'll see a bigger difference after a year. And if the kid's just acting out and they have good days and bad days and, you know, they're just being a kid, then you won't see this progressive change.
So what are the typical symptoms of GAHD? And how are they? How do you treat them? That's the hard part.
It depends on the age of the child. So I've always said that the younger a child is when their symptoms begin, the less likely they are to have chorea. Chorea are these sort of dance-like involuntary movements that actually used to be part of the name. So we used to call it Huntington's chorea,
right.
because that's the most noticeable thing. If you look at an adult with HD, most adults have a lot of these sort of dance-like fidgety movements. The younger a child is when they're diagnosed, the less likely they are to have that chorea, the more likely they are to have stiffness or what we call dystonia.
Mm-hmm.
A young child may be walking on their toes and have kind of a almost spastic or stiff-looking gait.
Mm-hmm.
There may be changes in oral motor function, so there's drooling. Yep.
Yeah. What about seizures? That kind of thing.
Yeah, so seizures certainly can occur somewhere along the line with juvenile Huntington's. They are said to occur in something like 25% of kids with juvenile HD. I've never been quite sure where that number comes from, and I'm not sure that it's accurate, but that's the number that is quoted.
Mm-hmm.
Seizures would be pretty uncommon as an initial symptom of HD. It would tend to be something that would come on, you know, sort of in the mid stages or later when there's much more brain injury from the disease.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing's impossible. You know, if a kid came in the door with a first seizure, Huntington's disease would not be at the top of my list of things to be thinking about. But back to symptoms that kids can have. So the motor symptoms is one. Mm-hmm. There also is going to be some change in cognitive function. And so kids, fortunately, I guess, they don't think it's fortunate, but kids are being tested all the time in school. Mm-hmm. So if you have somebody who used to be an A student and now they're drifting down to B's and next year they're down to really not doing well, you know, you'll see a fall off in the school performance.
Mm-hmm.
You can supplement. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You can supplement the school testing by doing more formal neuropsychological or cognitive testing, which is one of the tests that I would often recommend to get, if there's any concern about a kid, to do a kind of a baseline neuropsychological evaluation, preferably from somebody who knows the hallmarks of Huntington's disease. And so you sort of skew the testing to look for things that you might see in Huntington's disease. And then that serves as a baseline. You can do the testing again in a year or two. And if it's Huntington's disease, there will be a fall off. There will be a decline in performance.
You know what? I have to break in real quick here already.
All right.
Breaking in for a second. You're listening to Help for HD. This is Melissa, your host, and our incredible special guest tonight is Dr. Martha Nance. Our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. We are recording live, but you may listen again right after the end of the show. Just give it about an hour to propagate through the website. I've got upcoming shows in June, July, and August I'd like to tell you about real quick. June 27, Stacy Brookheiser with, she has a website, www.hdfreewithpgd.com. And July 5th, Giovanni Schifito with Crest E Part 2 series. And July 11, Doug Lowell, Find a Cure. July 18, To Care is another study, HSG study. This is a Part 1. July 25, Sean Thompson is with Predict Study. August 1 is Diana Rosas. She's with Crest E Part 3. And August 22, To Care Part 2. We've got a lot of clinical studies going on that we want to tell you all about. August 29, Diana Dunkelberger, she's with the Machowski Lab at UCSF. She's going to be talking about the immune system and the role of cannabinoid receptor type 2 and pathogenesis of Huntington's disease. And please go to Facebook and check out a new group on Facebook called Help for HD, Help HSG Awareness. Please join. It's an open group. We'd love to get your feedback. And so we are talking to Dr. Martha Nance right now, and I'd like to ask her a little bit more about symptoms of juvenile Huntington's disease.
Yep. So I'm very long-winded here. So I had kind of talked about motor symptoms and suggested that very young children may have more stiffness or rigidity or dystonia. And that there should be a change in cognitive function. There is also kind of the third part of Huntington's disease always is the change in mood and behavior. And in the patients that I've seen and heard of and been aware of with juvenile HD who presented with behavior as the initial symptom, it is not sort of subtle, mild behavior issues. It's burning down the school building.
Mm-hmm.
It's alcohol and drug abuse at age 12. So typically when there are behavior issues, there's not sort of mild and subtle. They are fairly dramatic. Moving into the teenage years, teenagers are a little bit more likely to have chorea and a little bit less likely to have the stiffness or dystonia, or they may have kind of a mixture of both.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody who's 18 or 17 when their symptoms begin may look for all the world like an adult with Huntington's disease. So it kind of runs the gamut, but the younger the person is, the more sort of stiff and the more really unlike adult HD it appears.
Mm-hmm. And so what are the differences between JHD and HD?
And adult HD. So obviously the onset age is how you define the two. And I suggested that the presenting symptoms may be a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
There is the thought that JHD is more likely to have seizures, so something like 25% of people with JHD have seizures. And it really is a pretty small proportion of adults with Huntington's who have seizures. There's more stiffness or rigidity in juveniles. And then the behavior problems often are, of course, behavior problems can be dramatic in adults. They can be dramatic in kids. They can be sort of not a big issue in either. Some people say that juvenile HD progresses more rapidly than adult onset HD. I've always been, I'm not quite sure that's really true. I've seen a number of patients who had juvenile onset of symptoms who lived into their late 20s or mid-30s. Mm-hmm. And if you add that up, if your disease started when you're 10 and you live to be 25, that's 15 years,
mm-hmm.
Which is sort of the average, you know, 15 to 20 is the duration that we often quote for adult onset HD. So I'm not sure that the duration is all that different. And then the other obvious thing is the underlying gene mutation that the gene mutation that causes Huntington's disease is this thing called the CAG repeat expansion, with any number being up to 35 being normal and any number above 35 having the potential to cause Huntington's. And most people with juvenile HD have rather much higher repeat numbers, at least over 50, and sometimes as much as, you know, 150 or 200. Whereas people with the more normal adult onset tend to have repeat numbers in the 40s. And none of that is absolute, but just sort of as a general rule.
Right. It looks like we might have a caller. Hold on, let me check.
Okay.
Hello, this is... Nope. Okay, sorry. You never know sometimes. We have people calling in, but they don't necessarily want to ask questions on live broadcast.
Yeah.
But anyway, you have just written the Juvenile Handbook, HD Handbook. So that's a wonderful thing that you've done. And how did that come about?
Well, you know, I actually originally wrote the Juvenile HD Handbook. I forget how many years ago it was. You know, I had kids myself, and I was seeing a couple of kids with juvenile HD, and I met some other families at an HD convention, and it was clear that the families with JHD felt that they didn't have all the information that they needed from all the other materials that HDSA had to provide or that their doctors had to provide, and there needed to be something that really was about JHD. So I actually just sat down and wrote this book and basically handed it to the Huntington's Disease Society and said, you gotta print this, and so they did.
Great. Will you be writing any more literature for maybe working with physicians or...
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. We are hosting the National HD Convention here in Minneapolis this year, so I hopefully will have the opportunity to meet with and talk to the patients and families with JHD that are at the convention and kind of get a feel for what's needed or what's missing or what's wanted or do we need to revise.
Open.
Yeah. So I'm open to writing more things.
And HDSA convention's coming up this week, starting on Friday, and Dr. Nance will be conducting several workshops and lectures Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So for those of you who are actually going to convention, be sure to catch Dr. Nance's workshops. They're going to be great, working with research and diagnosing and mid-stage, that kind of thing, people who are new to the convention, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So one of the sessions will be that I'm doing will be specifically for juvenile HD families. So I will hopefully meet whoever's coming in, and we can talk.
That's great. Oh, and another thing I just learned about that you are involved with a JHD initiative.
Yes. So I.
How is that going?
Well, you know, it kind of creeps along. I'm probably not the right person to really talk at length about it, but there is a move afoot among the clinical research community to focus attention specifically on GHD. You know, sometimes we add kids to a study of adult HD, but then again, the tests that we're using and the treatments we're thinking of, you know, tend to be more directed towards the adults, and sometimes you need to do things a little bit differently in kids. So there is a move afoot to try and really work specifically on children, not just as kind of an add-on to an adult study.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, behavior challenges are quite difficult, right? And emotions and outbursts, we can talk about that a little bit right now.
Sure.
And then we can talk about working with the schools. But so how do you handle some of these behavioral challenges in juvenile?
Yeah, so the first thing that you have to do is really kind of the emergency management. Everyone needs to be safe. So if the child is doing things that are downright dangerous, and might injure either the parent or another child in the house, you may need to call 911 just as you would if somebody was, you know, pointing a gun at you in your house. And I have had situations like that where the child with GHD was actively threatening a younger child, wrapping the light cord around their neck.
Oh, my goodness.
And that child may have to be somewhere other than at home for a little while. May need to be hospitalized on a psychiatric unit to get stable. So that would be the most extreme situation. Beyond that, you know, we try to work with parents and families to in the school system also to find sort of strategies or, you know, ways to pick your battles or ways to get the responses that you want. You sort of have to understand what's underlying the behavior. Is it truly just an explosion that comes out of nowhere? Or was it because the person was asked to do something they didn't want to do?
So there's triggers then that trigger these emotions, right?
Right. And if you can figure out what the triggers are, then...
Right.
Then maybe you can control them a little bit better or pick your battles. You know, do you really have to feed a kid with Huntington's disease carrots if they threaten to stab you with a knife every time you do it? Well, maybe you can pass on the carrots. You know, so which battles really, you know, on the other hand, running. Go ahead.
Yeah, are they using certain medications for children or?
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, it would not be surprising when you're dealing with medications that are really, or sorry, when you're dealing with behaviors that are really caused by a brain disease, it would not be surprising if it's not controllable just by coaxing and hand-holding and changing the environment. These people have a brain disease. And may need medications to control the symptoms, just as you know, somebody who has paralysis or spasticity due to a stroke may need some medication to treat the spasticity. They're not being lazy. It's not that the parent isn't working hard enough. You know, it really is a brain injury that's causing these symptoms. So medications may be necessary. There's a lot of backlash, I know, in the both the popular literature and the chat rooms and so on about doctors being too quick to use medications in kids. But this is a brain disease where medications truly may be necessary for the child's own safety.
We're getting ready to go off of our live segment already, live stream already. So let me just conclude the live portion of the show. We can continue to talk. There's more questions that I have. And this concludes our live portion of the program this evening, and I want to thank you, Dr. Lance, for a super educational, informative program, And thank you for doing what you do to help our HD and JHD people. Yeah. And you may contact Dr. Nance, and can I give them your phone
number? Sure.
612-873-2515. And you can email me at helpforhd@yahoo.com. We have a live broadcast coming up on Wednesday from the HDSA International meeting. So please tune in, and we're off already. So anyway, it goes fast, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does.
And I didn't mean to cut you off because you were
it's okay.
Talking about some really important stuff, but I had to do that. Anyway, so working with the schools, that can be challenging as well, right?
Yeah. I think it can be challenging, but it also I think is a benefit that adults don't have, which is that there is this whole set of people that already exist to help you. So,
right.
You know, here you are, a child with a problem, and you have this whole crew of people whose assignment, whose mandate is to optimize your ability to get through school. And, you know, they have to do whatever you know, at least in the public school system, have to provide what you need for your safety and an education program that's appropriate. Now, the challenge is you, the parent, are going to have to educate them about Huntington's disease. They don't know anything about Huntington's, and you don't expect them to. So you need to bring the juvenile HD guide in. You need to educate them, work with them, see if you can get them to come to a Huntington's disease support group or a conference or a meeting so they learn a little bit more about the disease. But you as a parent will have to advocate and know enough about the disease to educate these people so that they can in turn help you and your child. You know, kids with HD do need an independent educational program, and it has to change from one year to the next. What worked last year isn't going to work this year. Mm-hmm. The difference between the child with HD and his peers gets bigger over time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so one year it's a small difference, and the next year there's a little more and a little more.
As children move on and grow and progress.
Right.
In one way, the HD child progresses in a bad way.
Right, in a different direction. And so, you know, acknowledging that, you want your child to succeed. So rather than, you know, setting them up to do things that they can't do,
right.
you know, each year you reassess where you're at and you create a program that's successful.
Right. Now, do some of the kids benefit from physical therapy?
Well, absolutely. In the Parkinson's community, there's more and more literature showing that vigorous exercise actually helps to preserve brain cells.
Mm-hmm.
That's also sort of been shown in Alzheimer's disease. The research hasn't been done specifically in Huntington's disease, but gee, if it works for Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, it's not too much of a stretch to think that it might be helpful also in people with Huntington's. The mobility changes over time, and so there may be specific needs to adapt to the changes that have come along. So whether it's early in the disease to really work on an exercise program, activity level that's appropriate for the kid, or later in the disease to find the right assistive devices or equipment, both of those are going to be important. And incidentally, speech therapy is equally important. Probably the most important person on my HD team is the speech therapist. Everybody with HD eventually develops trouble with controlling their tongue and lips.
Mm-hmm.
And that affects both speech and also ultimately affects the ability to chew and swallow.
Mm-hmm.
The speech therapist can work on that both in terms of the speech side and the swallowing side.
Techniques
and actually technology for some patients, it doesn't work for everybody, but now that the iPad exists, that's such a beautiful, portable, convenient tool where you can combine, pictures and texts and words and preloaded words and so on. It's a wonderful way for some people, if they don't have severe chorea or severe rigidity, some people can really benefit from a what they used to call an augmentative communication device.
Do they have an app for that?
Yes, there's a thing called Proloquo to go.
Proloquo,
L-O-Q-U-O, to go. That's a wonderful program that works on the iPad.
And then
swallowing is a big issue. You know, morbidity and death in Huntington's disease tends to be related to difficulty swallowing. So people, you know, get pneumonia because
aspirating, that kind of thing.
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
So working on that.
Let's talk about the hard part. When is it time to create a care team?
On day one.
Pardon?
On day one.
On day one. Okay. So how do you go about doing that?
Well, so this is one of the...
You get the diagnosis, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the advantages of the Centers of Excellence, which is that they are supposed to, by definition, have a multidisciplinary team that includes a genetic counselor and a psychologist and a neuropsychologist or various different pieces of this, speech therapy, physical therapy. Your other team that sort of, again, exists automatically is whatever's going on at the school. And so sometimes it's an issue of sort of merging the school, you know, which things will you get done through the school? You know, you may have a more or less of a physical therapy eval through the school or a cognitive assessment through the school, and you may not have to do that in the doctor's office. If you live far from a center of excellence, or you feel like your center of excellence didn't quite get you what you needed, it may be a little more difficult. You may have to, as the parent, work to set up your own care team. Mm-hmm. And the way to do that, again, is to advocate and to teach the doctor. You know, and it could be your pediatrician that you say, you know what, I know you don't know about Huntington's. I just went to this great meeting. I got this great book about juvenile HD, and it says we should be seeing a speech therapist. Can I see a speech therapist? And it says we should get, you know, an MRI scan, and so can we get an MRI? You know, so sometimes you can work with the doctor to organize the pieces that you need. Being at a center of excellence sort of makes it easier because it should sort of already be there for you.
Sounds like another handbook.
Yeah,
I know. You know, we're in Central California, so we have L.A., which is 3.5 hours south, and we have Sacramento, which is 6 hours north. And because my sister lives up in the Bay Area, we've chosen to go north. It's easier to stop at my sister's and regroup and go on up to Sacramento. We love Dr. Vicki Wheelock. She's awesome.
Yeah.
And but, yes, you know, distance is an issue, and having to work with the doctors here on the Central Coast has been challenging. Have to admit there's a fine line between a mom trying to work with a doctor and having to kind of tiptoe around issues, not wanting to insult the doctor, but, you know, how do you do that? We need help.
Yeah, you know, again, sometimes it's easier. It seems like it's sometimes easier with the primary care doctor, just the general pediatrician, who I think may be more able to say, you know what, I don't know much about HD, but I am a doctor, and I know how to write orders for medications, and I know how to order therapy consults and so on. So let's work together on this.
Right.
So sometimes it's easier to work with somebody who doesn't sort of feel like they are supposed to know everything, maybe don't really. I've learned more from my patients, and I can freely admit that. You know, that each time I see, even an adult Huntington's patient, I still learn each time from that patient. So it's always a team effort.
Okay, well, you've recently revised the Physician's Guide to HD as well. So what are the revisions? And this is through HDSA. Everybody can go to hdsa.org and find the Juvenile HD Handbook and the Physician's Guide to HD, right?
Yep. Yep, so basically the Physician's Guide was 100% rewritten.
Okay.
So if you have ever seen the previous edition, that's swell and fine. I'm glad he did, but the new edition is new.
Okay, so we have more information in there.
Yep, and I have a chapter in there about team management.
Great.
There is a chapter, I think, about juvenile HD, which is pretty much just excerpts from the juvenile HD handbook. But we did include a separate chapter about juvenile HD. But as I said, we also talk a lot about team management. We talk about approaches to cognitive changes and so on. Research, a little bit about research, how to manage movement problems and so on. It's completely rewritten, and I'll be curious to see what people think. Hopefully they'll think it's good. And it's written, although it says Physician's Guide, and we do ultimately want it in the physician's hands, I think that all the authors, one of whom actually was Vicki Wheelock, who's your favorite person, we tried to write in a way that would be accessible to patients and families as well as medical professionals.
Well, we need all the help we can get, and we appreciate all that you are putting into helping all of us, because we're kind of, at least I feel like I'm out here kind of stuck in the middle by myself sometimes. It's good to know that there are people like you and Dr. Wheelock looking out for us and trying to help us in every way they can. So,
I think you have the advantage of living in the computer era, so you can do things like this blog and and communicating with people around the world who have JHD. It really is kind of a worldwide community now.
I have to tell you, Facebook has been pretty essential for that, because a lot of us are kind of stuck in the home. We don't get out very much. We have the telephone and the computer, and we can, pretty much function that way. So, we're very lucky to be in this age of technology for sure. Yeah. Now, you are working on some research projects?
Sure. We've worked with the Huntington Study Group for years on a number of HSG projects. I do clinical research. I don't do any laboratory or bench research, but we're involved in the two care study and the CREST E, the ones you're talking about in your next blogs. We've also been involved with the Horizon study that ended recently and the Heart study that there's sort of an open label add-on to that called Open Heart.
Mm-hmm.
We're also involved in the Prequel study, which is looking at coenzyme Q10 in people who are gene positive but not yet showing symptoms.
Are you doing anything with Enroll?
Yeah, so hopefully everybody in the world. the goal of Enroll is really to get everybody, the worldwide HD community mobilized. So we're hoping that Enroll hasn't quite gotten up and rolling yet, but it should be starting very soon. And hopefully we will be part of that, and so will everybody else.
Is HDSA involved in that at all, or are they going to be working with that as well?
You'd have to ask HDSA what their involvement is.
But the centers of excellence across the board will be?
I'm not sure. It would not be mandated that they would be involved in that specific study, but my guess is that pretty much all of us will.
Mm-hmm. Great. Now, You know, a lot of people out here are wanting to know how, you know, research and studies are going, and we're wanting to know, when is that cure going to be here, you know? We're hearing lots of very incredible, great things, but we're just going, okay, when is that cure going to be here? And we need to know that there's hope, you know. And so I'm wondering if you have any clue as to how things are going in that realm.
Well, the older I get, the tougher that question gets for me to answer. You know, I've been around long enough now to have my hopes and dreams dashed a few times, you know, where we did a study on a drug and thought it was going to be good and then it didn't turn out. So I get it from personal experience that research is slow and frustrating, and sometimes you take one step forward and two steps back. Research really is like being a pioneer in your little covered wagon going from St. Louis out to whatever that thing is at the end of the country. And, you know, the lucky ones got to California. But, you know, along the way there's, you know, potholes and famine and Indians and whatever else, you know, mountains to climb and blizzards and so on. And sometimes you feel like you take one step forward and two steps backwards. The thing that I think you might as well be hopeful about, who knows if it'll work or not, but if there was ever a disease for which gene therapy would work, it is Huntington's disease. And specifically the type of gene therapy called RNA interference or RNA silencing. Mm-hmm. If you could turn off that abnormal gene so that it never makes abnormal protein in the first place. Remember, everybody has a second copy of the gene that's normal.
Right.
So you get,
right,
you know, one copy from one parent and another copy of the same gene from the other parent. If you could shut down the abnormal gene without shutting down the normal gene, you would never get Huntington's in the first place.
Isn't that called single allele or something like that?
Yeah, well, so the general technique is called RNA interference or RNA silencing. And then the question is, how do you tailor that mm-hmm. technique so that it is specific for the gene of interest and doesn't kind of leak over to silencing other genes. And then the other problem is, how do you deliver it to the cells mm-hmm. that you want to deliver it to? And that's not a trivial problem either. When you're treating a brain disease, you might have to deliver it by a catheter into the brain. There will be some reports at the upcoming convention about how that research is going. I know they're working on it in monkeys.
The study at Massachusetts?
Yeah, so that's one group that's working on it. You know, there are several different companies or groups that are working on it, and, you know, we'll hear about it. But if there's something to be hopeful about, why not be hopeful about this gene therapy?
Yep.
Will it work? When will it happen? You know, who knows when this will all happen. But, boy, I can tell you that, you know, anybody would love to be the guy whose name is on the paper that says, you know, we found a treatment that stopped Huntington's disease in its tracks. So there's a lot of people working on this.
So we have a little competition going on?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, there's also the thought that a treatment that works for Huntington's disease may also be applicable or, you know, modifiable as a treatment for Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. So the people who are interested in Huntington's research are not just Huntington's researchers, but also researchers who really care more about Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. They may be looking at what's going on with Huntington's, or they may spend some time.
ALS.
ALS is another one. Yeah, that's kind of the fourth one in the list of famous neurodegenerative diseases. So you know, we're all kind of looking at what each other is doing, and a treatment that works for one may turn out to be applicable to one of the other diseases.
Right. Now, one thing we didn't cover, and I want to ask you real quick, is we're talking about the caregivers and our family members that are trying to deal with, you know, sick family members, and how do we cope, and how do we make time for ourselves and all that kind of stuff. So how, what is your recommendation for us?
So I think building a community and not trying to do it by yourself is critical. As I said, you know, do what you can to make the school be your ally. Do what you can to groom a care team. And if that means, you know, you need to find a doctor who's willing to listen and who maybe admits that you're the first juvenile HD person they've ever seen, but they're happy to read the book, you know, or whatever. And then, as I said, you're in this wonderful era where you can create an online community that gives you a little bit of support. It's important to realize what your strengths are and what you can do and which things you just can't deal with or can't do.
And it's okay to ask.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And it's okay to ask your physician if he'll help you.
Yep.
Sometimes
yep.
they don't know until you ask. Right?
Yep. And another thing I've been saying to both my adults and occasionally kids, we all try so desperately hard to keep our loved one at home. Because you think that home is where you should be. But I've had many situations with my my old folks with Parkinson's disease. You know, they're desperately still trying to live in the farmhouse they've been in for 50 years, and now they're 83 years old, and neither one of them can drive anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, and out here in Minnesota, you're basically jailed in your house for 8 months out of the year if you can't walk and can't drive. And if you move those people to a assisted living facility or a senior apartment where there's other people around, they blossom. Now, I've never yet met anybody who said, gee, I can't wait till my Parkinson's gets so bad I need to go to the assisted living, but I've had many people blossom when they made the move. Similarly, every so often you get a kid in an HD family who really does do better if they move out of the home. You know, so typically be an older teenager or a sort of a young adult with juvenile HD, you know, really struggling with behavior. It's having a terrible impact on the other kids in the house. Mm-hmm. You may be also dealing with a spouse who has Huntington's disease, and how do you manage, you know, three children, one with HD, a spouse with HD, and in the middle you're trying to work three jobs because you're the only one supporting the family. Mm-hmm. It may just not work. And I know a couple of families where the child has moved out of the house, and it was wonderful for everybody. The child had a whole new set of friends. They behaved differently around anybody else but their mom. And then mom could come and visit. And it is. It's true. I can tell you. It's exactly true. But, you know, then you
can have an open mind, in other words.
Yes, have an open mind, and you know, and it's okay to ask for help. Mm-hmm. That's probably the most important
thing.
Number
one, right?
Yes.
Oh, that's the hardest thing to do sometimes, right?
Yep. But, you know, your child will do better if you are doing better. And so if you need, you know, an afternoon or, a weekend every month, you know, make sure you get a weekend every month. Get your brother to come help out or get your, you know, whatever, whoever it is that's out there to help you out.
Good advice.
Yeah.
Well, I know that, you know, once once the condition has progressed to the point where, you know, it takes a constant care,
mm-hmm.
like round-the-clock care, it's pretty hard to leave at that point. But,
right.
you know, up to that right. point, you should try to take as best care of yourself as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I would comment. One of my favorite people in the world was a young boy whose disease started when he was two, and 2 years old had
wow.
Huntington's disease. He had been adopted by a wonderful family, and he never spoke after about, I think he had a bout of measles or chicken pox or something at age 8 or 9. And he was mute after that, never spoke again. But he continued to go to school. He continued to go to an exercise program. The kids in his class at school just absolutely took him on as their project. And they took care of him, and they loved him, and they would make sure he got suctioned when he needed to be suctioned. Mm-hmm. And he lived at home till the day he died. And I have up on my wall a article that was written, I forget if it was the community newspaper, or maybe it was just the school newspaper, that said, you know, little Billy is the awesomest, raddest kid. And it was written by the kids in the school. And this kid was a source of inspiration mm-hmm. to everybody around him.
Yeah.
So his life was short. He died when he was 16, I think. You know, his life was short, but it was meaningful, and it was beautiful.
That's incredible. And I haven't met a JHD kid that wasn't that way.
Right.
Personally, I have met, not personally met, but talked to online, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They have all been incredible young people. There's so much, you know, passion and compassion for other people and so much to give, you know, and they want to give.
Yeah.
And they're just incredible people. So.
Yeah. So your job is, as any parent's job, is to allow that to happen to its maximalist extent. And then you've won the fight. You know, we all die at some point, but if your child has lived to his fullest extent while he's alive, then you won the fight.
Mm-hmm. Incredible. Well, thank you so much. This has been an incredible show. And look forward to seeing Dr. Nance at HDSA convention this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And you have four workshops.
Yep.
And you've got, Friday from 1 to 2, workshop on new to the convention, right?
Yep.
This is Friday. 2:30 to 3:30, you have research and clinical trials, HDSA research and clinical trials.
Yep.
Saturday, 1 to 2, you have JHD onset and diagnosing.
Mm-hmm.
And then Saturday, 4 to 5, managing mid-stage. Really going to be informative and helpful lecture. So incredible, and I bet you're excited about having your state host the convention this year.
Yep. We're quite excited about it, and we hope that everybody has a wonderful time. And I hope to see many of the people who are listening to the blog. I hope to see many of them here in Minneapolis.
Oh, wonderful. I wish I could be there, but I'm planning on doing some live broadcasting. So we definitely will be broadcasting the International Youth meeting on Wednesday, and then I'm working with Fred right now to set up some live broadcasts for during the convention. They will be doing some webinars, live broadcast webinars as well. I'm not sure which ones yet. But it's going to be exciting. I wish we could go. Maybe next year. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah.
But
all
thank
right.
you again so much for coming on the show and for spending the time with us. Appreciate it so much.
Great. My pleasure.
And
we'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Thank you.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Good night, everyone.